TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction. Alan Rohrbach. Nuclear Famine and Nuclear Winter. Climatic Effects of Nuclear War. When Ronald Reagan, in the mid-1980s, in the middle of his two terms as U.S. president, in the middle of an unprecedented arms buildup, and in the middle of his Cold War campaign against the Soviet Union, suddenly showed interest in meeting Soviet General Secretary Gorbachev to talk about the reduction of nuclear weapons, the world took notice. How was this change of policy and maybe heart possible? Those close to Reagan say that he and his advisors realized and suddenly admitted that the nuclear weapons accumulated by the U.S. and Soviet Union could never be used because they would destroy the attacked as well as the attacker. Later, Reagan and Gorbachev made a joint statement. They said, "Nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought." Ever since the astrophysicist Carl Sagan coined the term of nuclear winter in 1983, an additional global risk became evident. Even a limited nuclear exchange would pose a grave danger to all life. If it was not by nuclear blast, fire, and radiation, it would be by nuclear winter. High-altitude dust clouds that spread through the stratosphere can block the sun for years and even decades over large areas of the planet and threaten the global ecology and with it the sources of food. Mikhail Gorbachev said in an interview in 2000, "Models made by Russian and American scientists showed that a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter. That would be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us, to people of honor and morality, to act." End quote. After the 1986 Reykjavik summit between U.S. President Reagan and General Secretary Gorbachev, the United States and the Soviet Union concluded two important nuclear arms reduction treaties. As a result, the number of nuclear weapons in the world started to fall. In retrospect, two factors played a huge role in those first steps on the road to limit and abolish nuclear weapons: a vibrant anti-nuclear movement and scientists who had the courage to speak out. And Alan Rohrbach, today's speaker, is one of them. Looking back at the 1980s, scientists then were supported by one of the largest and effective social movements in modern time. Some claim that in the U.S. by numbers, it exceeded the civil rights movement. Some say that the test ban treaties and the reduction of nuclear weapons would never have happened unless there had been a decade-long period of activism beginning way before the 1980s. And it was an international campaign. In the UK, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, was founded in 1957 in the wake of widespread fear of nuclear conflict and the radiation dangers of nuclear tests. In the early 1950s, Britain had become the third atomic power after the US and the USSR. In October 1981, a 250,000 people joined an anti-nuclear demonstration in London. CND's demonstration on the eve of cruise missile deployment in October 1983 was one of the largest in British history, with 300,000 taking part in London, as 3 million more joined them across Europe. In the U.S., on June 12, 1982, 1 million people in New York City's Central Park stood up against nuclear weapons and for an end to the Cold War arms race. It was the largest anti-war demonstration in history. International Day of Nuclear Disarmament protests were held on June 20, 1983, at 50 sites across the U.S. Many participants mistakenly believed that with the end of the Soviet Union, the danger of nuclear war had also ended. They turned their attention to other issues. Their overall goal of arms reduction was to have led to the abolition of all nuclear weapons, and that still remains to be done. However, in the last decade, up until 2015, very little progress has been made, and in some cases matters have gotten worse. The U.S. maintains its first strike winnable nuclear war policy, and the U.S. and Russia have raised their nuclear arsenals to a higher state of alert because of the situation in Ukraine. Furthermore, it has just been announced that the U.S. administration has plans to replace every nuclear warhead and their delivery systems via ship, submarine, missile, and plane at a cost of $1 trillion over the next 30 years. Professor Alan Robock was one of the acclaimed speakers at the symposium on the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction, organized by Dr. Helen Caldicott. Here is Helen Caldicott. She introduces Alan Robock.
The next speaker is Alan Robock, Distinguished Professor of Climate Science in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. His areas of expertise include climatic effects of nuclear war, effects of volcanic eruptions on climate, and soil moisture variations. His honours include being a Fellow of the American Geophysical Union, the American Meteorological Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Professor Robock is a lead author of the 2013 Working Group of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Alan Robock.
Thanks very much, Helen, for inviting me. So here's our beautiful planet. But after a nuclear war, it might look like this, with a cloud of smoke covering the Earth, blocking out the sun and making it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. There are two types of targets, ground bursts, and so the cities would burn and firestorms would build. Ground bursts also produce dust, and in one case, the sunlight gets absorbed. In another case, it gets reflected, but that means very little sunlight would reach the ground, and that would cause rapid large drops in surface temperature. This would be devastation to agriculture and natural ecosystems. The smoke in the atmosphere also heats the upper atmosphere, which then destroys ozone, and that would mean a lot more ultraviolet radiation reaching the ground, also which would be devastating for life. So this produces what we call nuclear winter, with cold, dry, dark conditions at the surface, more ultraviolet, producing crops dying and global famine. The first idea of this was by a paper by Paul Crutzen and John Birks, and then climate model simulations of the response were done by both Russians, Alexandrov and Stenchikov, and Americans, Turco et al. And I published a paper the next year showing the long-term effects. And the nuclear freeze movement was going on at the same time, as Helen described. And then the nuclear arms race ended. And this science was part of the story of why the nuclear arms race ended. The Soviet Union ended 5 years later, so it wasn't the end of the Soviet Union that ended the arms race. I'd also like to point out that the number by 2017 is not zero. We still will have 5,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, and that's still enough to produce nuclear winter. So the problem has not been solved. Why do I think we scientists had a role? Well, you can ask the people that made the decision, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. Reagan said, a great many reputable scientists are telling us such a war could end up in no victory for anyone because we'd wipe out Earth as we know it. If you think back to natural calamities back in the last century, in the 1800s, volcanoes, we saw the weather so changed there was snow in July in many temperate countries. And they call it the year in which there was no summer. Now, if one volcano can do that, what are we talking about with the whole nuclear exchange, the nuclear winter the scientists are talking about? It's possible. And Gorbachev said models made by Russian and American scientists showed a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that could be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us. So both these men who made the decision had this information from both Russian and American scientists telling them the same story. That was a powerful message. So that was 30 years ago. Why am I even telling you about it? I want to ask two questions. The Cold War and the arms race are over. Could the remaining nuclear arsenal still produce nuclear winter with temperatures below freezing? And now there are not just two nuclear nations, there are nine. What if a couple of the new nuclear nations, say India and Pakistan, had a war on the other side of the world? How would that affect us? So the answers to these questions are yes, the current arsenal can still produce a nuclear winter. And it will last much longer than we thought, decades. And a small nuclear war would not produce winter, that is, the temperatures wouldn't get below freezing, but it would be terrible direct effects, and there would be severe impacts on global agriculture for more than a decade. Now, unfortunately, we know that cities can burn. There was an earthquake in San Francisco in 1906, and Jack London was out on San Francisco Bay. He wrote, within an hour after the earthquake, the shock of the smoke of San Francisco's burning was a lurid tower visible 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this lurid tower swayed in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. And it produced a firestorm and pumped the smoke up into the upper atmosphere. All the buildings were gone except for some of the stone ones. This is what one of the survivors of Hiroshima remembers, which is the smoke and the fires. So we have this example of cities burning and producing smoke. The number of countries with nuclear weapons has increased about one every 5 years until the Soviet Union broke up, and now we have two more since then, and now we have nine nuclear nations. There are about 16,400 nuclear weapons in the world now, as of August 2014. Russia has about 8,000, the U.S. about 7,000. All these other countries have a couple hundred. Why did they stop? Why did they only have a couple hundred? How many nuclear weapons do you have to put on your enemy to deter them from attacking you? One. Okay, maybe two if the first one doesn't work. So why do we still have thousands? I mean, the U.S. and Russia could immediately go down to 200 each and not lose any of their deterrent ability, even if it were a deterrent. Now, Max talked about, Ted also, about how close we've come several times. What about this time? Imagine you're Pakistani air defense and you see an attack coming in over the horizon. You're a nuclear nation. Who do you think would be attacking you? Would you guess it was the United States, or maybe you'd think it was India? So did we almost start a nuclear war by going to get Osama bin Laden? We didn't, fortunately. But along the Kashmiri border, there are always disputes between Indians and Pakistanis. Imagine a skirmish there escalating due to poor communication, misunderstanding, panic, problem with the computer. In fact, last year I was at the IPPNW meeting in Kazakhstan, and I picked up the newspaper that morning in the hotel. Four people were killed when nuclear-armed rivals India and Pakistan traded heavy fire across the border early Saturday. This happens all the time. We've been really lucky that this, again, hasn't escalated into something worse. So we decided to look at what the climatic effects of such a war would be. So we took 50 Hiroshima-sized weapons and put them on the 50 targets in each country that produced the largest amount of smoke. And for India, this would produce 3.5 million tons of smoke. For Pakistan, 3 million, 6.5 million. We said, let's be conservative. Let's put 5 million tons of smoke into the upper atmosphere and see what the climate response would be. This is much less than 1% of our current global nuclear arsenal, 0.03%. Of course, it would be a terrible direct effect. 20 million people would die directly. So here's a movie of where the smoke would go, and most of it would be heated and go up into the stratosphere, the region above where there's weather, so there wouldn't be any rain to wash it out, and it would last for more than a decade, and it would cover the whole world. If you graph the climate response on a graph of global average temperature, so it would be a couple degrees colder, it wouldn't be winter temperatures, but this would be the climate change unprecedented in recorded human history, colder than the Little Ice Age. Now, two other climate models have recently done a similar calculation to make sure this is not dependent on one climate model. All three found basically the same result. This is the climate model at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is a much more detailed and also includes the effects of ozone. Our first calculation showed that the temperature would go down by, you know, 1.5 degrees Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And the Swiss model showed similar results. The NCAR model had the smoke last longer. It calculated in more detail in the stratosphere, and actually it would last for a couple decades. All right, so a couple degrees. What does that mean? So we said, let's take this and let's go to places where they grow food and apply the change of temperature, the change of precipitation, the change of sunlight, and calculate how crops would grow. First of all, the ozone would be depleted, and so now we worry about the ozone hole around Antarctica. This would be a global ozone hole with excess ultraviolet, and we haven't even had time yet to look at the impacts of the UV. All of those three climate models, looking at how the production of the main food crops in China, the country that grows the most food, would change. And so this is for 10 years, and for rice, it would be down by 20%, for winter wheat, 40%, and this is only in the first decade. So let me summarize this in a table. In the U.S., corn would go down by 20%, soybeans 15%, rice would go down by 25%, wheat by 40%. And it would last for more than a decade. And so you can imagine people hoarding food, world food trade collapsing. And we're now analyzing every crop in every country so we can go for the whole world and tell no more chocolate for you, no more wine for you. People can really have a gut feeling of how it's going to affect them, not somewhere else in the world. But it's much worse than that. Forget about what, it's much worse than that. Because as Ted mentioned, every Trident has 100 nuclear weapons, and they're much more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. So each Trident submarine can produce about 1,000 Hiroshimas. And the U.S. has 14 of them, and that's only half of our arsenal. And Russia's got the same size arsenal. So we could produce much, much, much more smoke if we used them. So we did a simulation of what would happen if the U.S. and Russia had a nuclear war. And a lot more smoke, it would go up in the atmosphere and cause much more temperature change. So now I'm going to graph the global temperature change. In the 5 teragram case I first showed you, so now for 150 million tons of smoke, 7 or 8 degrees Celsius colder, colder than the Little Ice Age. This is the same amount of smoke that we put in the atmosphere when we were studying nuclear winter in the 1980s, using a third of the then much larger arsenals. And we were trying to figure out, how can you still get so much smoke? Well, it turns out, with a third of the arsenal, every possible target in Russia and the U.S. had 9 nuclear bombs targeted on it, because they put one on, okay, let's put two on in case it doesn't work. So this huge pile of weapons, okay, let's bounce the rubble. So now if we just put one on each target, we can still produce the same amount of smoke, even after the new START agreement is in effect. And so if you look at global warming, then this huge impact. Now, just before you ask the question, yes, this would solve the global warming problem. I did a calculation. If you put that much smoke in and you stop producing CO2, the global warming is gone. I'm writing an article about that called A Modest Proposal, A Solution to Global Warming. So what's new in this work? A nuclear war between any nuclear states using much less than 1% of the current nuclear arsenal could produce climate change unprecedented in recorded human history. Such a, quote, small nuclear war could reduce food production by 20 to 40% for a decade. And we've repeated the nuclear winter calculations done in the 1980s, about which there was some doubt about would you really get temperatures below freezing. It turns out nuclear winter theory was correct. And the current arsenal, the Russian and American one, can still produce temperatures below freezing. And the effects would last for more than a decade. Now we have modern models that can heat the smoke, take in the upper atmosphere, and calculate how long it would stay there. In the 1980s, the climate model simulations were done on a Cray 1 computer. which is much less powerful than your iPhone in terms of its computing capability and its storage. So now we have modern computers that can do this much better. Everything I've told you so far is theory. It's based on models, the same models we use to do weather prediction and climate model simulations. How do we test this theory? We don't really want to do it in the real world, so we use analogs. We use things that inform us about parts of the story. We know it gets cold in the winter. You turn off the sun, we know it gets cold at nighttime. Unfortunately, we have examples of cities burning, both in San Francisco and during World War II, with so-called conventional bombs, which makes it sound like it's okay. And we have examples from volcanoes and Martian dust storms of this dust and smoke being transported around the world and causing cooling. Now, what should we do about it? So President Obama and President Medvedev signed the New START Treaty in 2010, and that pledged that within 7 years, each side would bring their nuclear warheads down to 1,550 per side. But strangely, each nuclear bomber counted as one nuclear weapon because they couldn't tell how many bombs there were inside of them. So maybe that means each country will still have about 2,000 nuclear weapons. So that's 4,000 nuclear warheads altogether, and maybe another 1,000 in the rest of the world. So what are the policy implications then? Immediate American and Russian reductions of to the same arsenals of the other nuclear nations, about 200 each, would prevent nuclear winter. We wouldn't be able to produce enough smoke to actually cause temperatures to go below freezing and sentence the entire world to famine. But if we want to prevent the famine that would result, maybe a billion people would die from a war between India and Pakistan because of the cutting the food supply, then we have to get rid of all the nuclear weapons. Now, Carl Sagan, who was one of the leaders about talking about this in the 1980s, said, "For myself, I would far rather have a world in which the climatic catastrophe cannot happen, independent of the vicissitudes of leaders, institutions, and machines. This seems to me to be elementary planetary hygiene, as well as elementary patriotism." So elementary planetary hygiene demands that we eliminate the nuclear weapons much faster than they're being eliminated now. So how do you feel? I'm really sorry to bum you out about this, to tell you about all this. So what can you do about it? Now, Mark Twain said, "Denial ain't just a river in Egypt." It feels good psychologically to pretend you didn't hear what I just said and go home and pretend it doesn't exist. And most of the world does that. Helen calls that psychic numbing. But another action is to try and do something about it to get rid of the weapons. So we've already banned biological weapons in the world, chemical weapons, landmines, and cluster munitions. But the worst weapons of mass destruction of all, nuclear weapons, have not been banned. And so the ICANN, the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons, is working to actually ban nuclear weapons. Max mentioned Dr. Seuss. I'll just end with another quote from Dr. Seuss. "Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing's going to get better. It's not." Thanks.
That was Alan Robock. He's an American climatologist and currently teaches in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. He's an IPCC lead author and was a member of the organization when it was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Next on TUC Radio is a talk by Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, an international organization with an over 2 decades record of education and activism on a rarely covered topic, the weaponization of space. Here's a short preview.
"I live in Bath, Maine, where Navy destroyers are built. These ships are outfitted with so-called missile defense systems that the Pentagon is today using to help encircle Russia and China. Few people in our community, including activists, are interested in where these ships go or what their military mission actually is, especially when Bath Iron Works is the largest industrial employer in our state. Soon after George W. Bush became president, he pulled the U.S. out of the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the ABM Treaty, that we had with Russia. That treaty limited the deployment of missile defense systems that are key elements in U.S. first strike attack planning. This led to the creation of the Missile Defense Agency, and today we see U.S. deployments of missile defense systems on the land and on board Navy ships being used to surround Russia and China. Each year, the U.S. Space Command conducts a computer war game in which they practice a first strike attack on Russia and China. They call it the Blue Team against the Red Team. And in this war game, the first weapon, an attack on China, is the successor to the space shuttle, the military space plane, that during testing has shown that it can stay in orbit for over a year without a pilot on board. It's really a super drone. In the computer war game, the military space plane drops down back towards Earth and hits China. Other weapon systems, under the direction of Strategic Command's Prompt Global Strike program, are then used in a further strike. Russia and China have repeatedly said that any hopes for real nuclear disarmament are out the door as long as the U.S. continues to test and deploy these missile offense systems.
Bruce Gagnon, coming up on the next broadcast of TUC Radio. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. If you are unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost by ordering on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. And the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. If you missed any of this information, call 707-463-2654. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.